I suppose a lot of us had some fun last week with Harold Camping's unrealized prediction of the rapture. I know I did. The rapture, of course, is ascent from the earth of the faithful, followed by all sorts of natural disasters that will rid the world of sinners and prepare for the return of Jesus. What I find interesting is that the concept of the rapture evolved from a much older concept, the eschaton, the end time, the culmination of this material existence, a concept that is present in many of the world's religions. Specifically, the Hebrew first century AD concept of the eschaton, in which the Messiah would arrive, the dead would rise up out of their graves, form a sort of zombie army, repel the Roman forces, and reclaim Jerusalem. Death would be banished, hunger and want would forever cease, weapons of war would be destroyed, and the whole world would recognize one God, or become Unitarians. Some historical perspective. By the first century AD, King David's once powerful army had been conquered, the first temple had fallen, and the Jews had been exiled to slavery in Babylon. The Jews had then been freed and returned to Jerusalem, built a second temple, been conquered again, and occupied by the Romans. They were only allowed to continue existing as an oppressed and defenseless people. The eschaton, then, is the story of a defenseless people with no army to defend them, a nation with no soldiers, and a dream of universal peace and justice. I'll get back to the soldiers in a minute. I think we all know what happened in 70 AD. The Romans had had enough of Jewish rebellions. The second temple was destroyed. There was a lot of death and destruction, and the great diaspora scattered Jewish people across North Africa, Asia, and Europe. Despite the famous Roman road system, Jerusalem was still a very isolated place, and there was extremely limited news coming in or going out. The world view was much, much smaller then. It is this near total isolation and the sudden destruction of a community that I want to stress. For many Jews, this must have seemed like it was the end time. And for those who were killed, in fact, it was their end time. What I am suggesting is that eschatons are subjective, they're highly personal, and they're nothing new. History is full of natural disasters that were eschatons for a population. The eruption of Mount Vesuvius 9 years after the fall of Jerusalem, Krakatoa in 1883 were both eschatons for those people. And eschatons are still happening. Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was an eschaton for the people of New Orleans. The earthquake and tsunami 2 months ago were eschatons for the people of coastal Japan. And the devastating tornadoes that have killed over 300 people this year, over 130 this week alone in Joplin, Missouri, are eschatons for the people of the Central States. An eschaton is a sudden breakdown of the physical and social order. I was in Winter Park for Hurricane Charley in 2004. It was a very sudden and fast storm. We are far inland, and nobody had predicted the damage it would cause beforehand. Our house shook. Trees were down everywhere. You couldn't drive anywhere for days. We were without power for more than a week. Cell phones wouldn't work. There was limited TV and radio. Stores, restaurants, and gas stations couldn't open. I had little kids to take care of. I was a little concerned about looting and rioting. Of course, Central Florida survived. We were fine a year later, but I had a small taste of what an eschaton could be like. Possibly there is something to be learned from Harold Camping about getting and keeping your spiritual affairs in order in the event of an end time, which could happen at any moment. While it is true that Harold Camping doesn't know when the end time is coming, what I found out from Hurricane Charley is that none of us do either. And according to fundamentalists who believe in the rapture formation of the eschaton, I suspect that most of us here would be stuck on Earth with the natural disasters, despite being good Unitarians. Go figure. Back to soldiers. One thing that gave me some relief right after Hurricane Charlie was that there were National Guard troops on the streets within 24 hours, clearing roadways, helping direct traffic when traffic lights were down, helping restore and maintain order. The National Guard are civilian soldiers, and that has been the primary function of the National Guard, to serve communities during natural disasters. Additionally, unlike the first century Hebrews, we have a regular standing army, a navy, marines, and an air force that we turn to in times of man-made disasters, attacks from outside forces such as Pearl Harbor and September 11th. And lately, the National Guard has been increasingly been used to supplement our regular standing forces, the combat units, whose resources are stretched thin for the past 2 years, fighting two wars in two locations. Let's spend a minute thinking about the environment these young and not so young men and women are enduring in those wars. War zones are chaos. They are noisy, smelly, hot, uncomfortable, loud, boring, and dangerous. The ground shakes with explosions. Even with the improved communication of this modern age, there is a sense of isolation from the rest of the world, a sense that what is happening to you is a unique experience. War shrinks the worldview to the immediate surroundings. And of course, death can come at any moment and should be expected at any time. This is a private eschaton. Every war zone is an end time for those who have responded to the nation's call to service. The men and women who serve in war must confront their own mortality and set their spiritual affairs in order. On Memorial Day, we commemorate those who have died and recognize the ultimate sacrifice that they made for our society. I know this congregation is of many minds on the morality of war, from total pacifists to believers in just war theory to those who have supported preemptive wars. But I think we can all agree that on some level, war represents a failure of the human imagination to deal creatively and constructively with the problems of human existence. Limited resources, greed, prejudice, nationalism, psychotic leaders. As a result of this lack of imagination, we create eschatons for our fellow citizens, mostly young, mostly male. Memorial Day is a social contract between members of the armed forces and the society they protect. They gave up their lives, and in exchange, we have this abiding tradition that once a year we will remember them. Really, they got a rotten deal. Remember that the ancient Hebrew eschaton ended with a dream of universal peace and justice. In 1950, the U.S. Congress passed a joint resolution requesting the president to issue a proclamation calling on the American people to observe each Memorial Day as a day for prayers of permanent peace. I think this is rather ironic, since in my opinion, it is Congress and presidents and not the American people who should be more mindful and intentional about making peace in the world. However, it would be unseemly to begrudge this small request when so many have been asked and have given so much more. To borrow freely from Pericles, when called to duty, none of our fallen service members weakened because they wanted to go on enjoying their wealth. No one put off the awful day in the hope that they might live to escape poverty and grow rich. More to be desired than such material things, they chose to answer the call to serve. This, to them, was a risk most honorable, and they accepted it, willing to take up arms and relinquish everything else. As for success or failure, they left that in the doubtful hands of hope. And when the reality of battle was before their faces, they put their trust in themselves alone. In the fighting, they thought it more honorable to stand their ground and suffer death than to give in to their fears, flee, and save their lives. So, abiding with life and limb, the brunt of battle, They escaped the shame of being labeled as cowards. In a small moment of time, the climax of their lives, a culmination of glory, not of fear, was swept away from us.
Reflecting on the meaning and reality of Memorial Day has become a challenge for many Unitarian Universalists. How do we commemorate and honor the fallen warrior without condoning or glorifying war? When looking at the way Memorial Day is advertised and promoted, it's easy to see how we may have become conflicted or even apathetic. For many of us, this weekend marks the beginning of summer. It's a day off from work, a long weekend, a great time to have a picnic with family and friends, a road trip, or scoop up sales at our favorite department store. While I'll happily admit to enjoying a three-day weekend, as we've heard already, the holiday's origins were intended to create space for reconciliation between the Union and Confederate states, soldiers, and for all Americans to come together and remember the sacrifice and schism our country had experienced. Later, Memorial Day became a remembrance for all of those who lost their lives in military service. As Reverend Kathy mentioned earlier, historical records are incomplete and divided, but the current meaning and intent of Memorial Day is captured in a quote from President Obama this week. He said, "On this Memorial Day and every day, we bear a heavy burden of responsibility to uphold the founding principles so many died defending. I call on all Americans to come together to honor the men and women who gave their lives so that we may live free and to strive for a just and lasting peace in our world." Memorial Day is not a picnic. It is not about glorifying war. It is a day of mourning. My wife, Nikki, and I returned last week from vacation. We were invited to join Nikki's mom, Debbie, and her husband, John, to experience the area of Mexico that they have frequented for years and are enthusiastic to share with friends and family. While we were there, we also celebrated Debbie's 66th birthday, May 21st. Coincidentally, on the same day, the world was predicted to end. It didn't. But we learned that day of a little tradition of Mexican song, birthday song called Las Mañanitas, or the Little Tomorrows. The Little Tomorrows. To consider our tomorrows, all the promises, hopes, and dreams that we have about our futures, unaware of when our world or when our lives will end. We realize on Memorial Day, the loss of all the tomorrows for the soldiers whose deaths we mourn. We know that it is not just the death of one individual, but their family and friends who receive the news, who must face their tomorrows with a tragically altered life. We mourn the altered reality of the soldiers who did not die, but who returned from war, broken in a way from which they may never heal. We mourn because their tomorrows are shrouded with fear and pain. Memorial Day is also a day of stirring music, of patriotism and flag waving. Wrapping oneself in the American flag may seem like a peculiarly un-Unitarian Universalist visual, but I invite you to consider this. As you use have a vast diversity of thought on religious and political matters with our roots in Christianity, Buddhism, paganism, Judaism. We are atheists. We are theists. We are liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, libertarians, members of the Green Party. Our theology is diverse, and with these diverse threads, we weave the fabric of our theology into a tapestry that is strong and beautiful. The same can be said of the American flag. It is not a one-dimensional icon owned by one vocal faction of our society. but one that symbolizes the whole of this vast melting pot of our nation. Pacifists and conscientious objectors have beliefs that differ from those who advocate just war theories, but we are all part of this fabric. President John F. Kennedy said, "War will exist until that distant day when the conscientious objector enjoys the same reputation and prestige that the warrior does today." The creation of a just society requires participants who share a common goal, even if they have different means. The fifth and sixth principles of our faith say that we agree to affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, and the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. In these two principles specifically, we are able to realize the guidelines for living out the honor that Memorial Day asks of us. In our continuing search for truth and meaning, we ask ourselves what we believe. What we believe is worth dying for. What we believe is worth living for. Choosing actions based on our principles and beliefs. Pursuing justice. Is this not patriotic? To honor those who have died defending the principles of justice and freedom, we strive for lasting peace. Eleanor Roosevelt said it this way: "It isn't enough to talk about peace. One must believe in it. And it isn't enough to believe in it. One must work at it." We too have a calling. It takes courage and bravery to work for peace. It is a fight against ignorance, poverty, and injustice. In his acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize, President Obama offered these words of hope: "It is an award that speaks to our highest aspirations, that for all the cruelty and hardship of our world, we are not mere prisoners of fate. Our actions matter and can bend history in the direction of justice." As Unitarian Universalists, we know that our actions matter. We are guided by principles that ask us to allow our values to shape our actions daily. Daily, we are challenged to commit our lives to action, working for the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Memorial Day is a day for prayer. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., we've been asked to unite as a nation in prayer. I'd like to invite you now to a moment of Memorial Day meditation. We come together to remember those who have died in military service. It is a time to remember with gratitude the men and women who gave their commitment, strength, and courage in wars they did not create and may not have agreed with or even understood, but for the love of the ideals and principles of their country, for the freedoms they hoped to preserve, gave the ultimate gift of their last breath. We come together to mourn for the individuals whose lives were cut short in acts of violence, for the brokenhearted families and friends left behind to face life's continuation without this loved one. We come together to honor the meaning of this loss and seek to find ways to honor and commemorate their lives and deaths. We come together wrapped in our flags of patriotism, whose threads are woven tapestries of honor, courage, and strength, knowing that working for peace is courageous, that fighting for justice is honorable, that committing ourselves to that goal is the highest honor we can bestow. We come together with our full hearts to follow our paths with individual acts of courage and with strength multiplied together in this beloved community of justice seeking and justice creation, to create a more understanding world where peaceful coexistence can be realized. May our commitment to this work never cease, as our memories and our actions continue to honor the ideals of freedom and justice. So be it. My nephew Alex celebrated his 13th birthday yesterday. We are full of hope and joy in his youthful exuberance toward life, and we are delighted in sharing the promise of all the tomorrows he may realize. Along with our birthday wishes and las mañanitas that we sent to him, we sent him a check. What do you give a 13-year-old? Which we learned he decided immediately to spend on a wakeboard safety vest, not the paintball gun he had been talking about all week. It's just a little thing, but maybe his spirit will grow more peaceful surfing the waves rather than playing with toy guns. May all of our tomorrows see growth toward a just world with no more fallen warriors.